I'll try to fill in any gaps that she might have left. I can't imagine what they are. Hi. Oh, no, it wasn't that. Alrighty then. Intuition versus rigor. This has been one of the major issues in discussions of what it means to do mathematics, literally for millennia, since the Greeks announced rigor as the important thing. And you'd be hard-pressed to find any text or any discussion of the nature of the discipline without the topic of rigor and intuition coming up. Now, that's not true of resources in about mathematics teaching. There is some spillage. Some resources in mathematics teaching do deal with intuition and rigor, but where and when they do, it's almost always framed in terms of its role in formal mathematics. And I think that's a bit of a mistake, because formal research mathematics and teaching children to do mathematics in schools aren't at all the same projects. So to look at one for the role of rigor and relative tuition to intuition and to apply that in another context is not a good idea. However, there is a domain that looks at such phenomena as rigor and intuition and has offered us some really interesting insights into it and is, I think, quite a bit more appropriate to discussions of the teaching of mathematics. And that domain would be the cognitive sciences. In terms of the issue of rigor, what the cognitive sciences are beginning to offer us is sort of a rigorous understanding of intuition. And that would seem kind of an important thing in a discussion. And in a conference such as this, where as I move from session to session today, I have noticed that the understandings of intuition have been mainly intuitive. So what I'm aiming to offer here is a more rigorous understanding of what intuition might be. Now, cognitive science is a relatively new field. Its root system extends into, and I'm going to give a couple of lists today, partly because I like giving lists, but here are some of the fields that cognitive science comes out of. Sociology, psychology, neurology, linguistics, artificial intelligence, computer science, and cybernetics. And that's just to name a few. And as you might expect from that diversity of influence, there's a lot of variation in opinion represented among cognitive scientists. So I don't want to make the mistake of portraying the field as though it's unified and coherent. It isn't. It's like every other field every other domain of human activity, conflicted. But that being said, there are some consistencies coming out of the cognitive sciences, and especially over the past 10 years, and especially with the development of brain imaging technologies that almost have reached the point that we can watch the brain doing things in real time in relative to real tasks. Now, that capacity to watch neurons and cluster of neurons interact has prompted a broad realization among cognitive scientists that some deeply ingrained assumptions about learning and thinking are problematic. Things like learning as a matter of taking things in, thinking as a matter of logical processing, wrong. And needless to say, if those beliefs are wrong, then certainly schooling structures and teaching practices that are developed around those beliefs might be a little bit problematic. And we've witnessed a testimony to some of those problematic structures today, as people wonder how these structures emerge. Anyway, before I dive too deeply into these topics, let me make a couple comments about the structure of what I have to say. One is that I'm going to be tossing up a half a dozen references I go through in the form of a photocopied book cover. And I'm doing that for a couple reasons. One is that I want to provide some means for anybody interested in reading more about these things to follow up on it. The other reason is that I don't want you to think I'm a total crackpot. These ideas are coming from somewhere. I'm not making them up. It is a rather substantial and a rigorous body of research. So, yeah, that's the first one. Second comment before getting into things is that my comments are going to be focused mainly on the pre-grade 9 levels of mathematics. That's where my research interest is. And I mention that because I believe there's quite a distinction between the projects of pre-grade 9 mathematics and post-grade 9 mathematics. And that difference is evident in the nature of the topics that are studied in those levels. For the most part, in pre-grade 9 mathematics, It's topics that are immediately interpretable in terms of everyday experiences. You just name a topic, I'll give you an everyday experience that topic can be used to interpret. That's not so much the case in high school topics, and the reason seems to be that the high school topics are mathematics applied to the objects of mathematics. There's a recursive elaboration that happens with the high school topics. Now that means that I think that means that we should be teaching pre-grade 9 somewhat differently than post-grade 9. Because if one set of topics can be used to interpret everyday experience and the others can't, then we certainly shouldn't be nesting them all in the same category. All right, here I go. First of all, addressing the issue of the assumption of a gap between intuition and rigor. One person who's had a profound influence on how we think about matters of thought and learning and rigor and intuition, less directly, is Sigmund Freud. Through his psychoanalytic theory, and in particular through his development of the unconscious as the unseen part of the iceberg of human knowing. Now, Freud argued that most of what we know, we don't know that we know. We just know it, or we just do it. And Freud's description of the unconscious was a tremendous contribution to 20th century psychology. And certainly, while I'm not actually going to draw directly on psychoanalysis here, those of you familiar with the theory will hear echoes of some of Freud's insights in what I have to say. The main reason that I don't draw explicitly on Freud is that his version of the unconscious was coupled to the belief that humans are naturally aggressive and greedy and selfish and duplicitous and sex-crazed, cruel, generally brutish, with only a veneer of social responsibility, and well, having spent 10 years in a junior high classroom has provided me ample evidence of that suspicion. It's not completely correct. Humans are not radical individualists. We're deeply social creatures. And let's face it, Freud based his theories by studying the oddballs. And you can't really generalize, although we often do, to the population. So, moving along. I mentioned this bit about the unconscious up front because the unconscious, or as I'm going to call it, the non-conscious, because I want to distance myself a little bit from Freud, figures prominently in current work in the cognitive sciences. And I want to leave some of Freud's conceptual baggage behind. But much as I would like to leave that baggage behind, I'm quite aware that some habits of thinking refuse to be set aside. Like, for instance, in discussions of rigor and intuition, just a sec, I have a transparency. Rigor is almost always cast as something of the conscious mind, whereas intuition is of the non-conscious, whatever the non-conscious is, usually associated with the bodily. Rigor is explicit. It has to be out there. Announced. Intuition is allowed to remain in the space of the implicit and the tacit. Rigor is ideal and universal. Once you have a rigorous demonstration, you can carry it anywhere. Intuition is flawed and contextual. Rigor is logical. Intuition is illogical, sometimes analogical, sometimes supporting of logic, but not logical. Rigor is reasoned. Intuition is rooted in emotion and sensation. Rigor is demanding and hard-won. Intuition is fallible. And this is an interesting point. We generally treat intuition as a given. It's just there. You work from the intuitions that you have, whereas you have to work toward the rigorous understanding. And rigor is in the realm of the scientific, whereas if we associate this with realms, intuition is kind of a more art thing. All right. Now, I color-coded these two columns blue and red for a couple reasons that I could have added to these lists. Blue is on my hot water on my bathroom taps the cold, and the red is the hot, and they kind of go with the way this is happening. This is the cold hard fact side of our being. This is the warm fuzzy part of our being. I did get it backwards, didn't I? There, sorry. The other is the male-female dimension of it all. And let's be honest, there is a real sexist dimension happening with these concepts of rigor and intuition, because you never hear the phrase men's intuition. You don't. And by the same token, men are the rigorous ones, right? Women's intuition. Well, yeah, right. All right. Sorry, I've lost my page. So, my point here is that in terms of popular assumption, this is popular assumption, not the way things might actually be. There's quite a radical split and quite a tidy split along many dimensions. From a cognitive science perspective, though, this is all very strange. One of the metaphors that I've heard used several times today is that rigor and intuition are endpoints on a spectrum. In fact, from a cognitive science perspective, they're not at all the same phenomena. They're rooted in different cognitive processes. So to put them on the same spectrum is kind of a strange thing to do. These are two different processes. You can talk about them as complementary, but you certainly shouldn't be talking about them as points on opposite ends of a spectrum. I'm going to speak briefly about some of the geometric principles that have sunk into our language that support the kind of dichotomous thinking that underlies my capacity to make a chart like that. One way of describing the past several decades of research in the cognitive sciences is in terms of a broad and slow realization that the assumption of rigor and intuition are separable is just that, an assumption. The relationship between these phenomena are more subtle and more complex, and a better understanding of that relationship has some really huge implications for the teaching of mathematics. But before getting into that, let me make a claim and then try to demonstrate the point. Sorry, I have two piles of things going, and I'm just not good at this. Here's my claim. Explicit schooling structures, I didn't write it in my paper, and teaching practices tend to be framed in terms of mathematical forms that are implicit in common sense beliefs about what thought is and how learning happens. What I'm claiming is that mathematics teaching has been mathematized, but not on the conscious level, or at least not currently on the conscious level. I think it was conscious once. For that matter, just about every aspect of our modern Western world has been mathematized. And again, it's sunk to the non-conscious level. Western culture has been very selective in its choice of mathematical truths to embody in its mathematics teaching, and they're drawn mainly from Euclidean geometry. And I'm going to try and give you to point to some places where that pops up. Certain mathematical forms have worked in their common sense. Here's one, the word plane, and the Latin root of, and all of the words that are related to plane in English. And there's quite a big family of them. This is just a small smattering, plane, plan, planet, and plank. All come from the Latin root planum, to roam about, and appear in phrases like plane geometry, airplane, planar, plane language, plane truth, plane and simple, lesson, plan, plan ahead, and you could go on and on and on. Now, these things actually have something in common. They assume a similar geometry. They assume a flatness, a levelness, a directness. I'm going to try and make that point a little bit clearer with my next transparency. Now, I know some of you are thinking I'm trying to yank something out of the air, but I'm not. If we look at some of the English words that go along with the word line, this becomes much more obvious, and I hope I have enough space on there. I do. All right. These first two columns. Right, a whole host of words that have wrecked in it, and I, no, don't say it. Regular, rule, line, a whole host of words that have ortho in it, and the word straight. All of these are associated with Euclidean geometry, and all of them come from Latin, Greek, or German words that mean straight. And all of them are mixed up in a whole host of other things that have fallen outside of geometry. Right, for example, right angles, right of way, righteous, right-handed, right and wrong, human rights, rect that we find in rectangle, correct, direct, rectify, rector, erect, and I'm very proud of that I didn't put down rectum. But I just can't resist saying it for some reason. In regulation, regulate, irregular, rule, all over the place, line, all over the place, ortho, all over the place, straight, all over the place. So this table is hardly exhaustive. Let's see, I need to read this. I strictly limited myself in this project to words that are explicitly aligned with prominent Euclidean notions. In truth, I could easily justify extending the list to include several other ordinary terms whose ancient roots and contemporary associations have to do with linearity, including all of the words italicized here, the big ones. If you go to an etymological dictionary, all of those words, come out of words that meant straight or aligned. Now, that's pretty interesting. The predominance of linearity in the English language. My point here is not that the emergence of this particular web of association represents some sort of error or conspiracy. It's just that the terms are pervasive. They're present in our communications. They infuse our habits of interpretation, and in the process, they do a particular sort of work. They help to project a sense of how things are. And as I hope is evident in the third column, beneath the literal surface of these terms is a mesh of rightness of wrongness, of correctness and falsehood, of straightness and queerness. In English, straight lines are knitted into how we think about good and evil, truth and deception, morality and deviance. Straight lines aren't neutral, inert, or benign. Check any thesaurus for the word straight. This is what I got from the one that sits on my desktop. Accurate, candid, continuous, direct, heterosexual, honest, simple, thorough, trustworthy, undeviating, and virtuous. That was in the index, and then, of course, I was supposed to turn from the index to elaborations of these connections. Now, who could argue with that list? To say that there are problems with these qualities would be deliberately provocative. It would certainly be illogical, and it would certainly be twisted, bent, kinky, maybe even cracked. So, I mean, we have to be attentive to our habits of speaking and the way that our language has been mathematized. Now, straightness and rightness are not just a pervasive part of the collective conceptual world. These ideas are built, we have built these ideas into our physical worlds. Consider, for example, the rectangular timetable taped to the corner of the rectangular desk in the rectangular classroom at the end of the rectangular hallway in the rectangular school on the rectangular block in the rectangular city that you would locate by looking in the rectangular grid on a rectangular map that looks a whole lot like the rectangular schedule that's taped to the corner of the rectangular desk. I mean, we are rectangulated, or our worlds are. But that shouldn't be surprising, because, of course, the rectangle is right, it's straight, it's regular, and it's all those other good things. Now, it's important to underscore that it's not like lines and planes were the only choice when it came to mathematical forms that might be used to interpret and structure the world. There are lots of other possible geometries, and it's interesting to review the history of mathematics for an examination of the subtle tyranny of Euclidean geometry over the last 2,000 years and shutting down possibilities for other geometries. For a few millennia, Euclidean geometry worked to shut out different possibilities that were almost literally staring mathematicians in the face. A nice history, and before I present this reference, I will acknowledge that it is flawed. Bill Higginson picked it up one day while he was in Edmonton and reported on some of the errors the next day. But it's still kind of a lovely book as a history of geometry and a trace of some of the interesting geometric possibilities and looking at, I mean, the title Euclid's Window. That's looking at the world through the window of Euclid and through the window of a whole bunch of other geometries. How does that transform how we look at the world? Lovely text, and one that I've been using in some of my research working with junior high and high school classrooms, reading them passages of the different geometries. The guy writes very well, and the kids just eat it up. That, you mean there are other ways of thinking about this than the stuff that's located in the textbook? Very nice text. Anyway, one of the geometries that he talks about in there, and it doesn't give quite enough space to, in my opinion, is fractal geometry. Now, fractal geometry has, of course, been picked up by economists to describe stock market activity and a whole bunch of other things, in medicine to describe bone structure, how bones knit together, how babies emerge, in botany to describe plant structures, and in evolution to describe the emergence of family trees of species. None of these phenomena is linear. Now, that doesn't mean that we haven't traditionally thought of them as linear. We're all familiar with this image of scrambling simian to weapon-toting Caucasian male. Now, there's a whole lot of cultural assumption nested in that image. But the thing that's relative to what I have to say today is the linearity. We all go in straight lines. Well, if you look in Scientific American these days, this is the sort of image you'll find representing the evolution of the human species. Something much more fractal. Something that branches and branches, branch into branches and branches, branch into branches. And if you went to an extreme, you could locate yourself at the end of some branch somewhere. It amounts to a shift in image from the direct line to something more spreading, more fractal. Now, when I said a little bit earlier that rigor and intuition belong in different camps, if you analyze the language around rigor, it's this. It's the linearity. If you analyze the language around intuition, and I don't have the time to do so, but it's not hard to do, it's this. It's this spread. It's this spray of possibilities. It's a completely different geometry, conceptually speaking. And this is one of the big points of cognitive science. An excellent reference, and I would be academically remiss if I didn't try to flog my own wares, but is a book that I wrote with a couple colleagues on what teaching would look like if we adopted a different geometry. Engaging Minds is an attempt to redescribe learning, teaching, and a whole cluster of things around it, schooling, through a fractal geometry rather than a Euclidean plane geometry. And teaching looks quite a bit different if you do that. Okay. I'm going to beat up one more thing. The word normal and the word standard. Both come from Latin terms that were essentially meant right angle. Not really right angle. Norma was a carpenter's square, but of course used to measure the right angle. Standard meant to stand up, which is to say form a right angle of yourself between yourself and a plane. And that's how they came to refer to right angles in English. Now, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, normal has a really interesting history, and I'm going to take 5 minutes to talk about that history because it's really important to the manners in which schools have been structured. According to the OED, when the word was first incorporated into English about 500 years ago, it was, of course, used to describe the accuracy of a carpenter's cut, how close it was to 90 degrees. Really, really close made it normal. A little bit off, well, that was an abnormal cut. Now, by the early 1800s, with the advent of mechanization, industrialization, there became a need for precisely manufactured parts. And the word normal slipped outside of the bounds of right-angle cuts to refer to the accuracy of any measurement because, of course, they needed replacement parts that were much cheaper if you produced them en masse. So any measurement could be normal or abnormal, depending on how close it was to specification. And then statistics arrived on the scene, and sociologists and psychologists picked up on statistics, and the word normal had this funny elaboration where it moved from the objects of the physical world into any construct. And normal became the arithmetic average, and abnormal became a deviation from the arithmetic average. We all know the normal curve, where the green space within one standard deviation is typically regarded as the stretch of the normal. And then the further you move from one standard deviation from the mean, the more abnormal you are. So normality and abnormality picked up really interesting definitions then. By the turn of the last century, the year 1900 or so, the idea of the normal man was big. And it really was the normal man. All the tests were based on men, strangely enough. And in the process of defining the normal man and all of the normal man's attributes, not just the physical attributes, but of course normal intelligence and normal tolerance of ambiguity and normal interests in whatever, they also plotted normal development. So development psychology arose, psychometrics arose, they defined abnormality and deviance and dysfunction, and exceptionality, of course, because exceptionality is dysfunction on the other end of the chart. In Alberta, and I suspect it's probably the case in BC, but I can't remember, in order to secure funding for students who are experiencing difficulty in any domain, you have to demonstrate that they fall into the red zone. And if you can demonstrate they fall into the red zone, you get extra money, whether they fall on the good side of the red zone or the bad side, on whatever. And that just means finding a standardized test that give you the results that you want, I guess. Anyway, supported by a new science of normal ability and normal development, the early 20th century saw broad developments towards standardization of curricula, of textbooks, of examinations. And this is the phenomena that we're dealing with today. It is the phenomena of normalization, I think, that has prompted our worries about the balance of rigor and intuition in the teaching of mathematics, because all of a sudden we have to get this herd of people in very different places to a certain place at a certain time. Well, isn't that a strange thing to be trying to do? It amounts to that the line won out in schooling. Every aspect of learning and intelligence and ability has been linearized along with every schooling structure, it seems. I can't think of one that doesn't obey the line in some manner. Now, this has been especially the case for mathematics, and largely because mathematics was assumed to be so tidily defined. It's the easiest one to line up. Let's face it. That's probably not a good thing. So there are lots of problems with normality, and I want to highlight two. The first is that not all natural phenomena are normally distributed. Here are a few that are not. Avalanches, city growth, crystal development, the spread of disease, earthquakes, extinctions, forest fires, grasshopper populations, nuclear reactions, stock market crashes, war, and the list could go on and on and on. Not normally distributed. In fact, they follow what's called a power law, which means that ones of double the magnitude are four times less likely to happen, or four times the magnitude are 16 times less likely to happen. This is a distribution with distribution of deadly conflict according to the number of people killed. So there were only a number of conflicts. In the neighborhood of 1,000, where more than 1,000 were killed, and in the neighborhood of 10 million, where a few were killed. Okay, power distribution. The list, once again, of things that follow a power distribution. A power law, I mean. Now, these things all have something in common. They're all dynamic phenomena. And it seems to me that most of what we deal with in the classroom should fit in this kind of category, not the normal distribution category. So here's a place where normal might not be the right thing to be applying to issues in education. Here's a reference that is quite new that I very much like, Mark Buchanan's Ubiquity. It's a very easy, it's an afternoon read kind of thing, but he goes through the power law, its applications, and in particular, how fractal geometry is a very useful set of forms to understand these distributions. Okay, a second problem with the idea of normality is illustrated by this little question. Now, the question is, which one of these figures is most different? And it didn't come out very well, but this dot is gray, not completely black, and this border is gray. Everything else is either black or gray. Oh, this background is white. Okay. So the question is, which is the most different? Have you got your answer? The answer is the one in the middle. And it is the one in the middle because everyone else differs from the norm in one way. Upper left differs from the norm in that its center is not black. Upper right differs from the norm in that its border is not black. This one differs from the norm in that its border is squarish, and this one differs from the norm in that its background is white. Now, the one in the middle is the most normal, in other words. And in being the most normal, it's abnormal. And this is actually more than a joke, because when you take this kind of idea to something, to a population that is defined by its differences, that self-defines by its differences, it turns out that the idea of the most abnormal person on the planet would be somebody who is really normal. There's no such thing as a normal person, and yet our schools, our curricula, our examinations are structured around this fiction. Now, that's an interesting thing, and there's been some really interesting writing, both in logic and in education, around the fallacy of the normal man, normal person. All right. Skip that. Okay, I want to tell you about a person that I'm working with named Krista. I just lost my starting page. There we go. For the past 6 months, I've been meeting weekly with a grade 9 student named Krista. And I've been tutoring her, initially as a favor to some friends, but it's become something more than that. Krista has had a history of difficulty in mathematics, and to give you a sense of that difficulty, at our first meeting I was asking her some questions to try and figure out what she could do and what she couldn't do. And we started out with things that were kind of at grade level, questions based in algebra, and I quickly moved backward, questions based in fractions and integers, and backward. And finally I said, Krista, what's 7 plus 7? And Krista went, 13. And I thought, okay, we're in trouble. Again, this is a 14-year-old grade 9 girl. I asked her many, many questions about multiplications. She did not know what multiplication was. She knew some products through memorization, but she didn't know if she got them right or not and had no way of testing. So, in a nutshell, it was immediately clear that Krista, who was really personable and otherwise capable, very popular among her peers, seemed to be completely lacking in mathematical intuition. She had no feel for the mathematical ideas, no sense of how things fit together, and lacking these intuitions, she had no hope for any rigorous understanding. For her, mathematics was about manipulation of meaningful symbols, nothing more. And she knew she wasn't very good at those manipulations. It's something we've all witnessed as mathematics teachers. Students who seem to be stuck in the belief that the figures in front of them are inherently meaningless and that their task is to figure out how to shift them around appropriately to get the grades. Krista was, of course, the most extreme case I've ever personally encountered, simply because she didn't know what 7 plus 7 was. She couldn't explain what multiplication was. She couldn't describe any sort of relationship between a half and 0.5. I handed her a piece of paper at one point and asked her to fold it into thirds, and after 4 tries, she gave up. This is a grade 9 girl who can't cut a piece of paper into thirds. So my immediate response was that Krista must have been one of those people that fit into the category of an Oliver Sacks case study, somebody who had some specific psychoneurological damage that prevented her from being good at mathematics, from being able to do any mathematics. But because I had made a promise to a friend that I would help do what I could with Krista, I didn't reveal my initial apprehensions. Instead, I plowed ahead, completely ignoring what she was studying in her class, and started to play with folding pieces of paper. Now, Bill, second time I've mentioned Bill, but Bill mentioned a couple days ago in a different presentation that he thinks you can teach all of grade school mathematics through paper folding. So I claim something like that, right, Bill? Something like that. Well, I'm inclined to think he's correct. Because Erica and I folded paper for 4 months. Folded paper talked about adding, talked about subtracting, talked about multiplying, talked about dividing, got into a little bit of algebra. And we even, using pieces of paper, invented this phony economy where the value of the bills changed every day. And it was based, is a fraction bills based, you could, if you wanted change, you gave a person a dollar and they, or we called them a glot. You gave the person a glot and they owed you half a glot in return. They folded it in half and gave it back. And that was your half a glot. It was a very strange thing, but it worked with Krista. She started to get some things. Anyway, a couple months ago, we began to shift the focus to activities that reflect some of the more formal aspects of mathematics, and for the past month, we've concentrated almost entirely on algebraic manipulations, which is where she is in her math class. To make a long story short, Krista was tested a couple weeks ago by her school district, and they have an annual funding-related event for that happens kind of at the end of April, where they test everyone, or mid-April, I guess, test everyone to see who gets funding and who doesn't get funding the following year. Now, in every previous test, Erica fell outside the normal ability range in mathematics. And the same was true of this test. I mean, who would expect you'd get very far in 6 months? There was a difference, though, because this time when she fell outside the normal range, it was a year ahead of her peers, not 7 years behind. So somehow, in 6 months, according to those standardized tests, and I don't put much faith in them, but I think they do indicate something. Somehow, in the course of 6 months, she progressed something like 8 years in schooling in mathematics. I, of course, want to attribute it to brilliant teaching. But that would be a bit of a lie. Her achievement was the product of a complex set of interacting factors, like a change in attitude. She was actually working at it for a change. Like hooking up with a like-minded set of friends, and we can't underestimate the importance of the people you hang out with for doing well in mathematics. Like some success in other pursuits. She made the basketball team, was doing really well there, and other things. I'm pretty sure that the teaching, or probably teaching isn't the right word to call it, the tutoring had something to do with it. I do recognize the luxury of being able to work with a person one-on-one as opposed to working with the person one-on-31. I mean, that is a different experience. But the amazing thing to me is that I actually didn't do that much. I invented some situations. I presented them. I was there to chat with Krista. And I would describe what I was doing in terms of this. I've been trying to readjust the balance of rigor and intuition in her experiences. Or if we were to look at that chart, which is well buried here, moving from the blue side to the pink side and saying it's all right to live over here. In terms of what I actually, the question that I actually asked myself to orient what I was doing was, when I looked at a concept and tried to decide how I was going to approach it with Krista, I asked the question, what sorts of experiences might this concept be used to interpret? Not, how can I explain this? Which was the question I asked when I was a teacher. But what sorts of experiences could I have Krista engage in that would make a difference? And having asked that, I've noticed, because I've started recording these things, that this is what we do most of when we meet for our 90 minutes weekly. I do something, Krista copies me, and copies me, and copies me. And sometimes she copies the same question. Sometimes the whole 90-minute session is one question that would take, that you would give 3 minutes for in a regular classroom. And Krista does it again and again and again and again, explaining herself as she goes. The explaining herself as she goes is a big thing. Krista does most of the talking. When we get the transcripts back, because I'm also having these transcribed, it's maybe one page of me talking, every now and then prompting, saying something like, wrong, and 15 pages of Krista talking. Lots of practicing. Lots of practice exercises. She's required to do homework every day if she's going to participate with me, and those practice exercises are pretty repetitive. Lots of interpreting. When she does something, it's not just a matter of talking aloud about what she's doing, but interpreting it by interpreting, I mean hooking one category of experiences into another category of experiences. So describe this in relation to that. And we do a great deal of that. All right, so why is that working? There. Here's an odd reference. This is published a couple months ago. Rodney Brooks is an MIT robotics kind of guy in one of the MIT artificial intelligence labs. There are three of them, apparently. Flesh and Machines, How Robots Will Change Us. Rodney Brooks describes... Rodney Brooks is considered, I guess, no longer a young Turk, but kind of a radical in artificial intelligence and robotics, and has a hard time getting published in the mainstream journals, and is regularly trashed. Do an internet search of critiques of Rodney Brooks' work. It's interesting. The one thing is, though, that Rodney Brooks' robots work, and no one else's do. And that's just an interesting thing. He develops all of his things around an explicit rejection of some of the assumptions that other artificial intelligence and robotics people are making. In particular, he builds all his robots around two assumptions. Now, it bears mentioning that since the 1950s, the main things that have been driving developments in artificial intelligence and in robotics has been the assumption that to have an intelligent machine, you have to have two things. One, a great big database, and two, a really powerful processor or parallel processors. And if you can combine those properly, you'll have something intelligent. Brooks is working from a completely different approach. His machines tend to have very weak processors and sometimes no database at all, other than a couple instructions about how to act in the world, about if you bump into something, turn. That's part of what he means by situatedness and embodiment. A situated creature or robot is one that is embedded in the world and which does not deal with abstract descriptions, but through its sensors, with the here and now of the world, which directly influences the behavior of the creature. And an embodied creature or robot is one that has a physical body and experiences the world, at least in part, directly through the influence of the world on that body. Now, it may be a horrible thing to say and sound very odd, but when I read this a couple months ago, my immediate response is, oh, that's how I've been treating Erica. Like a Rodney Brooks robot. As situated and embodied. Particularly the embodied. Speaking of embodied, George Lakoff and Mark Johnson, you may have heard or read their book, Metaphors We Live By, published, I think, in the late 70s, maybe early 80s. I don't really know. A huge big seller. This is a very weighty tome. 700 or 800 pages. Very dry read. The very best part of it is in their first three lines. The mind is inherently embodied, thought is mostly unconscious, and abstract concepts are largely metaphorical. Sorry, I definitely used the wrong color of ink there. And the book goes downhill from there. But these are three of the major conclusions of cognitive science, the last 50 years of cognitive science, because really that's as long as cognitive science has been a coherent discipline. Now, that's in contrast to what tend to be the popular assumptions about how the mind works. And I present those as sort of popular opinion. The mind transcends the body, thought is conscious, and abstract concepts are logically structured. Thinking is logical. Wrong. More correct. Sorry, I've lost my place. Oh, well. Let me make a few glancing blows at artificial intelligence research, at least artificial intelligence research of the 1950s variety, when confident predictions of robots that would rule the world were being made by scientists and science fiction writers alike. Those predictions seem to be based on the fact that early computer science work had tremendous success on getting computers to do things that humans found extremely difficult, mathematical tasks. And they figured, well, if we're so good at that, in no time at all, we're going to have robots that will rule the world. Well, in fact, 50 years later, nowhere near, the smartest robot is nowhere near as intelligent as relatively dim three-year-olds who can work with language, who can recognize faces, who can discern objects from background, who can understand humor, who can do all sorts of things that computers aren't even close to doing. So what was the big mistake? Well, one of the big mistakes was that it was assumed that the brain operated logically, that thinking was logical. And in fact, thinking is not logical. Thinking is metaphorical, mostly. It also operates on a lot of other analogical structures and narrative structures. But cognitive science has a huge body of work that demonstrates that the ideas that we have are mainly metaphorical. So what? Well, Lakoff paired up with Rafael Nunez a couple years ago to write Where Mathematics Comes From, How the Embodied Mind Brings Mathematics into Being. And his project in this particular text was to demonstrate how the epitome of abstraction, formal mathematics, is rooted in bodily experience, bodily action in the world. In this book, Lakoff and Nunez move from the basic metaphors that we have for counting and adding all the way through to Euler's formula, e to the pi I plus 1 equals 0. Their project is to try and demonstrate that e to the pi I plus 1 is rooted in such basic experiences as walking. Now, it's a long book, and they move through the metaphors that we have for infinity, the metaphors we have for integers, all the way up to... I'm not entirely sure they succeed. I've read the book twice, and it's like reading a math text in very many ways, kind of dry. But it's an interesting project, this claim that the high point of modern thinking, modern abstract thinking, is rooted in the most basic of bodily experiences. Whether or not you actually believe they succeed with Euler's formula, you can't deny that they succeed with certainly all of the operations that we try to teach in grade school. Anyway, what's my point? I do have a point. Terms like embodiment, non-conscious, and situated, which are now plastered all over the place in the cognitive sciences, fall into that same category thing that we call intuitive. It's that category of knowledge that moves us from functioning into living. It's almost always in the background. We're rarely, if ever, aware that certain parts of our knowing, specifically those parts that spring from the fact that we have bodies that must act appropriately in particular situations, that fact tends to get lost. Here's a book that I highly recommend, Tor Norotrander's The User Illusion, Cutting Consciousness Down to Size, which he opens up with some interesting factoids on the size of human consciousness. It turns out that if you total up all the human sensory perceptors, from the light-sensitive cells in the back of the retina to the nerve endings in your fingertips, it's somewhere in the order of 10 to 15 million in any given body. 10 to 15 million sensory receptors in your body. In terms of the number of sensations that can pass through and be noticed by consciousness, that's in the neighborhood of 10 to 20 per second. Our body is immersed in this sea of experience that's a million times larger than we are consciously aware of, that we can possibly be consciously aware of. And the suggestion that Norotrander develops in the book is that in terms of the ratio of thought is kind of in the same order, that the amount of thought that's happening in your head in terms of cognitive process of associations being made, of neurons firing together, is about a million times larger than you're aware of at any moment. Now, that's just an interesting little factoid and kind of necessary. I mean, if you had to be aware of everything that you were doing while you were doing it, you would be shut down. Something as simple as walking is an enormously difficult thing to do, and just ask anybody who has had specific damage to the part of their brain that dealt with walking. You can't relearn how to walk as an adult. Some kids can if they have the damage done early enough. But as an adult, it's too overwhelming. Our brains are no longer plastic enough. Walking is too big of a task to relearn. And yet we can walk and chew gum. Chewing gum also is a very large task. These are things that exist in the realm of the intuitive. Intuitive, a million times larger than the conscious. Yet what do we focus on in the instruction of mathematics? The conscious. It's as though we're trying to squeeze this opus, this huge body of knowledge, through this tiny little opening into this vast cognitive space. So perhaps we should be focusing on the intuitive, on experience, on common experience, on talking about those common experiences with others, and not necessarily bringing that to rigorous analysis very quickly. A phenomenon that you've probably all noticed, I noticed it about 10 years ago when I reached that age where my friends and siblings all had kids who were kind of in junior high school, coming home with questions that suddenly mom and dad had to help them with, these very questions that they struggled with 20 years ago. To a person, everyone commented that, oh my God, I now get this stuff. Like, what's going on? This was so hard 20 years ago, and it's also obvious now. Well, why would that happen? That would happen because of the weight of interpreted experience in that 20 years. If only they could have drawn on that experience 20 years previous, they would have been geniuses in their junior high math class. Well, that should tell us something. Another interesting phenomenon. Plop a 10-year-old in a playground of people who speak a different language. In 3 months, she'll be close to fluent. Plop a 10-year-old in a second language classroom. And in 10 years, she'll be lucky to utter a sentence without a thick accent. That should prompt we educators to step back for a second and say, what are we doing wrong here? It's the focus on experience, the focus on situated experience, the focus on working with others to interpret experience. So we've just been getting it wrong. All right, that's my point. The past century has seen some really unfortunate initiatives in mathematics education, most of them disastrous, and every one of them aligned with the geometry of linearity and the assumption that learning is mainly a matter of acquisition of rigorous knowledge. The most obvious of these was the new math in the early 1960s. That was a huge mistake and a big disaster, and that's because it was mostly contrived in ignorance of the embodied dimensions of personal knowledge. New math was let's face it, new math was all about formal knowledge. Let's ignore intuition, let's ignore the non-conscious dimensions of cognition entirely. A more current initiative, but one that I find just as worrisome, is the desire to move computers into every classroom and to have every child have a computer to work through their mathematics. And I think a subtle part of that initiative is reducing the size of the teaching force I think the hope is that computers will be able to handle some of the more mundane aspects of teaching kids things. Well, I think that's a mistake, and it's a mistake because computers are actually built, deliberately built, to match with the size of human consciousness. It only feeds you 10 to 20 bits of information a second. We are sensory beings. There's been some really interesting research done on people whose jobs are based on sitting in front of computers, or on people who live in their basement spending too much time on the internet. Turns out that these people are suffering from sensory deprivation and with some severe problems. Now, the interesting thing about that is that if you look behind the internet, and this is a picture that appeared in National Geographic a couple years ago, a map of the internet. I don't know how well that's showing up for you, but when I turned to the back page and saw this, I thought it was a mapping of the brain. But in fact, it's a mapping of the internet. Because it's fractal. It was deliberately structured to be fractal. It was patterned after the brain, of clusters, clustering into clusters. That kind of structure is robust. That kind of structure has a lot going for it. And it's the way intelligence and memory and other things seem to be structured. Using the wrong geometry to structure our teaching of mathematics. Simple point. So, I'll end with the comment that we as educators need to be careful not to maintain the mistake of relying on a single geometry to make sense of the complex phenomena that we deal with. Lines don't cut it. And one way to respond to the call to be attentive to more different geometries is to pay much more attention to learners' intuitions, to screw the rigor for a while. Let people live with the ideas, discussing with one another. It's not an easier way to teach, by the way. I've worked really, really hard developing the activities with Krista. And again, I understand the luxury of working with one person, but amazing things can be done if formal knowledge can somehow be rooted in the vast body of experience that we have, and we all have that huge body of experience to draw on. That's it. And I deliberately pressed it to the end so that I wouldn't have time for questions. Sorry.
The way that you portray this, and I'm sure, I don't think you mean it this way, but it's an either-or type of thing. I think that was probably most manifest in your slide representing a power law, which was linear. But it was represented in a linear manner. So, I guess my question is there some sort of higher order interaction that perhaps we should be looking here for here between the linear and the non-linear? Or are you advocating, let's give linear a break for a while, and see what nonlinear has to offer, and then perhaps think about it.
Well, technically, you asked an easy question. Yes. it's about higher order interaction. I mean, one of the things that's coming out of psychoneurology is that we are biologically predisposed towards the line. There's something about this line that really makes our brain fire up. So it's not surprising that we would use this biological predisposition and impose it where we can. So it's not, we need to toss out Euclidean geometry. It's that we need to understand, if we're going to get any further than we are, that some of our preferences are rooted, are troublesome and need to be elaborated. And it's more about elaboration than replacing, just like fractal geometry isn't a rejection of Euclidean geometry. I mean, it's really interesting elaboration. I think there is space for elaboration on how we think about things by invoking a different geometry. Besides, we wouldn't be able to get rid of the lines if we tried. So. Dave.
I have a simpler, although maybe not as easy, question. Could you give us a particular example of a situated experience that you worked with Krista?
Sure. We spent the first 3 weeks just folding paper. And that was based on the fact that the word multiply means many folds. But it turns out that there's a whole lot more going on with simple folds. And in fact, we did multiplication of fractions. And like a simple thing, like what's 2/3 of a half? Well, fold the paper in half and then fold 2/3 of it, and there's your answer. And it's that quick. So there's, forget the business of check the numerators and denominators to see if there's a common factor and reduce before you multiply, because otherwise you'll have to reduce after you multiply. I mean, what's that all about? Ignoring what you're being asked. So, I mean, Chris is really good at multiplication of fractions. You know, the one topic that we haven't touched on yet, well, I've allowed her to use the algorithm for division of fractions, invert and multiply. But I haven't got into trying to explain why that happens, why that's workable. I actually did for 5 minutes and thought, whoa, I'm undoing a lot of good work. So, I mean, we still allow some things to go on the level of just do it. That'll take us to a more interesting place. But I would urge everyone here to go fold paper. Look in the curriculum guide and fold paper. It is amazing which topics lend themselves to folding.
Allows you to bring lots of pieces of paper
into her
tests?
Well, no. And the funny, you know, in the last report card, Krista went up across the board. Her average went from about 45 across the subject areas to about 75 to 80, except for mathematics, it dropped to 40. So her mother doesn't care, thankfully. Krista, me, and her math teacher are involved in a bit of a war. That's another part of the story. That has more to do with the importance of attending to the personal relationships among people than about the mathematics in this particular case. A website is under construction and should be up in about 2 months. It's called engagingminds.ca. Not CA, not com, CA. But it's not up yet. It's not supposed to be up anyway. So we're working out the bugs.
Your first analysis of Krista/Erica was...
Did I say Erica out loud?
Yes.
I knew I would do that. Oh, well.
You said that she was completely lacking in mathematical intuition. Was that the symptom or the cause?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it, there's a place where you can't pry apart symptom and cause. It was certainly both. I won't say the story. It was an interesting case of talking to a wall. What was more interesting, you could talk to her about anything else. And where we actually connected was around the TV show Friends, which I watch religiously, in which she has the dialogue memorized. And an important event early on was mentioning to Erica that, for me, numbers were like the characters on Friends. They all had personalities, and I got to know these personalities. So that when I looked at one of the things that I tried to have her work through was number patterns. And she would look at them and not be able to do anything with them, like the triangular numbers, nothing. The squares, nothing. I comment, okay, when I look at this set of numbers, I see that they all have this particular trait in common, and that's why this family has been nested together. Just like watching Friends. And since then, she's been looking for the character of the numbers that she's dealing with. And that's really interesting. Like, she finds 60 a really interesting character because of everything that goes into 60 and the way 60 shows up all over the place in really interesting places. So she's become her memorized... Well, I don't think they're memorized in quite the same way, but her capacity to spit out the products of numbers is now up to about 20 times 20 with extreme confidence. And she just kind of, she's doing it by knowing the personalities of the products. Or she'll spit out a product and says, no, that can't be right because 72 doesn't behave properly to be the product of that number. So, and it's just a really interesting thing.
Thank you very much.
helped me to survive the last few days before the conference. And I hope that we'll all see each other next year at about the same time.
Thank you.